And please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Adrian from Riverton, New Jersey.
Hi, my name's Adrian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Adrian.
Is this all right? Yeah?
Yes.
Good to go. I feel like it's right in my line of vision, though, and I need to see my people. Sorry. I connect better, right, when I can see you. I don't want this thing in front of my face. So my name's Adrian. I'm an alcoholic. Last time I was up here, it was pouring rain, so I don't know what's wrong with you people up here with the rain. I asked last time that when I do come up, you bring sunshine for me, but clearly you can't follow directions. So I'll forgive you this time. My hair would have looked a little nicer. So I actually got up here yesterday. My sister lives, 2 miles down the street. So my sister, who's not an alcoholic, and her husband, who's not an alcoholic, and my cousin, who's not an alcoholic, are here tonight. do I have to not like hold stuff out? Like, what do I say? But I went in the bathroom and I got quiet. So, and I asked God for direction and to allow this to be his talk and not my talk. So here it goes. So my home group is the Unshakable Foundation in Voorhees, New Jersey, which is pretty cool just by its title. I love to just talk about that a little bit because our literature out of the 12 and 12, it says that prayer and meditation is an excellent tool to have in our tool belt, right? To get quiet and connect with this power that's supposed to be directing my life on a daily basis is really something that's important and fundamental. It's also equally important to have this self-examination throughout the day. Step 10, as we go through the day, we clean up our mistakes, we look for selfishness, fear, resentment, and these things that make us uncomfortable and block us from tapping into that power. It also states in our 12 and 12 that when they're logically interwoven, they form an unshakable foundation for living. And on most days, I can tell you, I feel like I'm on pretty good ground. Most days, not every day. So when life comes at me, you know, people still lose jobs and we change employment and people die and things don't go my way just about every day. And how do I handle that and how do I walk through life? Not just sober, because for me, it's not really about drinking anymore. It's about having that inner peace, right? How do I walk around on a daily basis with serenity? How do I walk around on a daily basis and go to a job, you know, where you have all these different personalities and whatnot? And how do you deal with family? Everybody's different, right? And life happening, how do you deal with that? You know, there's some tragedies that happen. You know, a friend of mine just recently got diagnosed with terminal cancer. And, like, how do you deal with that? You know, we're supposed to walk through our emotions and walk through our fears. But I want to do that with grace and dignity today, right? And I don't want to ever get to a place where I'm so uncomfortable that a drink might become an option, you know? And I've seen people get to that point where drink's not an option, but really bad behaviors are, right? And I've seen people, you know, make the ultimate sacrifice because they can't go on anymore, right? And they're sober, right? I didn't get sober to be miserable. Actually, I didn't even know why I was getting sober. I was getting sober because everybody was on my case. but I didn't know what I was signing up for. But the outcome was this incredibly beautiful life where I can live today in peace and serenity and connected and tap into this power on a daily basis that directs me. And whenever I feel and the least bit uncomfortable, I can always turn to that power, right? I believe that we're spiritual beings having a human experience, and that, you know, our book says deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. I actually can take that a step further and say that I believe I am a piece of God, right? I was formed out of nothing. Just this little energy cluster that got formed into a human being, and this soul is within me. You know, it's not the outer thing that defines me. It's my soul. It's what's inside. And And I don't know. I mean, how do I want to live this life today? You know, So the unshakable foundation, that's where I was with that. So I'm on this unshakable foundation on most days. And when I find myself not practicing prayer and meditation and definitely not doing a self-examination, not drifting into morbid reflection, not beating myself up or anything like that, but just checking myself on a daily basis, which my ego will justify anything, right? So that's why I need you people. I need my people. As soon as we pulled in the parking lot, I thought, oh, my God, my people. You know, like, I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. This is now my passion, right? I didn't know that living a life of service was going to become a passion for me, like an inner knowing. Like I know deep down inside to my tippy toes that I belong here. You know, there's no doubt in my mind. And I belong living by these spiritual principles, and I belong being of service to God and His children. And there's no doubt in my mind whatsoever, at all, ever, so far in 4 years, that this is exactly where I'm supposed to be, what I'm supposed to be doing. I found my purpose in life, right? I found my purpose in life at the age of 43. I got sober July 24th, 2013. So I just celebrated 4 years. And I can remember that day like it was yesterday. For most of my life, I've been drinking and drugging. You know, out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll just tell you right now, I was, you know, I loved cocaine. And that's enough said. So that was always, drugs were always a thread throughout my story, but the one constant was always alcohol. And I was able to walk away from some other substances, but I wasn't able to walk away from the alcohol. And the alcohol took me out hard, and it took me out fast in the end. I know I suffer from a progressive illness. So I came in here, you know, I've drinking and drugging since I was 17 years old, maybe before that. I can now that spending the day with my sister walking through the woods today, had memories of smoking weed up in Elverson with my friend Stephanie when we were probably little kids, finding her brother's stash and taking it up into the cornfields. And rocking down the corn and sitting in there trying to smoke weed, you know, as a kid. And so, but when I was 17 is when it all really started happening on a daily basis. I started with acid and cocaine, and it was beautiful. I loved it. I was late to school every day. Went to Holy Cross High School. I was late every single day because I was doing bong hits at my boyfriend's house, and I was late every day. And so that's how it started, right? Then I fell in love with some other substances, and I actually kind of identified myself as this woman that was going to be like the hot chick on the drug dealer's arm, living that lifestyle you see in movies, right? I was going to climb the coke dealer ladder and be successful person like that. Some of my friends call it a coke whore, whatever. Call it what you want. It was fun until it wasn't fun anymore, right? So I was able to walk away from that lifestyle, right? I was probably, when did I move in with you in your basement? I was 27 years old, and I was like walking away from that scene, right? I didn't want to be in the penthouse apartment in Palm Beach. Not sure why I didn't want that anymore. I didn't want the house down the shore. Not that it was my house, it was the drug dealer's house. The apartment in Center City, I was just done. I was done with it, and I moved into my sister's basement, and I figured if I married somebody that my dad liked, that my relationship with my dad would get really, really good. Makes sense, right? So I married this guy and held him hostage for a little while, and he insisted I was an alcoholic, but he was lying. You know, I actually went to Alcoholics Anonymous a couple times in that first marriage back in 1999. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous with a giant, you know, big gulp filled with wine or vodka tonic or something. And I had a second one for the ride home. And I went late, cried the whole time, hated all of you, and left early. And I went home and said, see, I'm not an alcoholic. I don't belong there. And So that was my first experience with AA. And then, you know, they were going to do like some sort of intervention. So I ran away to North Carolina. That was fun. And I stayed in North Carolina for a few months until I was like killing myself with drinking. My shopping cart consisted of nothing but bottles. And I was there for a couple months and I finally left. And then I went to live with my mother. Because, you know, that's what we do. We move into basements and back bedrooms. I don't know, like, life continued. The drugs I was able to walk away from, like I said, maybe dabbled here and there, but the alcohol was a constant. My brother-in-law, we'd go out to dinner. I got to talk about it because you're here. I'm sorry. My brother-in-law would take pictures of me at that restaurant on Route 73, and they'd put, like, food on my face and take pictures of me. And they go, see, I think you have a drinking problem. You know, and I'd be like, no, I have a brother-in-law problem. You know? And, like, they were trying to point out that I have a problem. You're passed out at this beautiful restaurant. We're putting food on your face, taking pictures, you know? And I don't know. My sister was always telling me I did too much of everything and I needed to slow down. And I don't know. That's just how I rolled. But most people I would just push away, you know. If you didn't roll like I rolled or you told me that I did too much of something, I thought you were disposable and I just kind of cut you out for a little while and moved on to someone else and entertained myself that way. And then it just all just got really bad, you know. I was drinking 24/7 around the clock in the end there and I work in the medical field, so I wear scrubs to work. And I would fill my pockets in the morning with little airplane bottles. And I would go to work if I could. I had the first, you know, I would go to work, and at lunchtime I'd restock. And on the 23rd of July, that particular morning, I can remember, I had to get out of bed, I had to drink. You know, my body was so physically dependent. I was so sick without the alcohol. And I was so sick with it, you know, and I would reach under the bed. I'd wait for my husband to leave, my current husband to leave, and I'd look under the bed for some bottles and so that I could get the alcohol on me, just so I could brush my teeth, just so I could get in the shower, just so I could get to work. And I made it downstairs that morning, and I can remember standing over the kitchen sink, and I'm sick. I'm so sick, I'm gagging, I'm throwing up nothing, bile, and I'm trying to get the vodka in me, and as soon as it hits my mouth, my body's rejecting it. I got tears coming out, snot coming out, vomit. I mean, it was a mess. Spitting over the kitchen sink, and I had that, like, moment, like, holy shit, man, you gotta stop drinking. Like, I'm 43 freaking years old, and I'm finally deciding I have to stop, right? When I can't breathe without drinking, I finally have this light bulb moment that I need to stop, and clearly it's going to be completely impossible at this point. I wasn't doing any drugs except handfuls of Zofran. I don't know if any of you know what Zofran is. Zofran stops you from vomiting. It was my best friend, man. I loved it. I would write myself, this is how I know I'm not like a real junkie, because I had prescription pads that I would sign, right? And I would write myself prescriptions for Zofran and not Perc 30. So clearly I'm straight up alcohol. Alcohol and Zofran. And I would eat them all the time because I was so sick. And so I got the kind that melted on your tongue, right? So I'd pop a handful of Zofran just to get that off and the vodka would go in and... You know the feeling, just the ease and comfort, like, oh my God, it's going to be all right. I'm going to make it through today. I'm going to be all right. And I'd have a few drinks. My sister taking me for some surgery. Where was I going? A surgery on my breast. And my sister picking me up, and I'm like, wait, we can't go yet. I got a drink. You know, and she's like, what is wrong with you? I got, leave me alone. You know, I'm going to have surgery. I have to drink. God forbid the surgeon. I did bleed out. Oh my God. I forgot about that. I bled so bad. It was horrible. Gary's like dying over there, right? Remember that? My underwear was covered in blood. It was a mess. Anyway, we won't go there. But I forgot about that. And so, you know, and so I'm popping the Zofran and I'm drinking and I can finally get myself right, right? I can go upstairs, I can brush my teeth and I can get in the shower, and there's a shop right near me that sells the alcohol, but the end caps are not tapered off in the morning. Like, you can still grab right in the refrigerator department. And I would grab 2 4-packs of wine. I'd go to the checkout. I'd load up my pockets. I'd drink all morning. Lunchtime, I go hit a liquor store. I load up, make sure my handbag's nice and full of airplane bottles. And that particular day, the day that I said, holy shit, man, you got to stop drinking, is the day I got sober. Well, not that day. It was the next day. But I ended up having this, like, mental breakdown at work, crying jag, you know, and I blamed everything on PTSD, right, because I was a victim of a violent crime a few years before that, so everything was that fault, right, an awful, awful thing that happened to me I used as an excuse to protect me, my drinking habits, right, and so I would say, oh, I'm having PTSD, and the nurse, I work in the medical field, like I said, and the nurse went in and got my handbag for me, and she saw the airplane bottles in it, and she said, I think you have a problem. Like, no shit. and I was found out. And well, I don't think the nurse was going to say anything, but I was running on fear probably 2 months prior to that, right? So here's fear directing my life. I was reading the employee handbook for months prior to that. That same clause in that handbook that if I go to them first, they have to save my position. Right? They have to offer me treatment and they have to save my position. And clearly this was the day to play that card because I just got found out. Meanwhile, they'd been finding me passed out in my car for 2 hours at lunchtime. I would go in the bathroom just to lay on the tile floor to cool my face off, right? In the middle, and I'd be in there for an hour and they'd be pounding on the door, Adrian! You know, like, I had been found out. I just didn't know I was found out. And so I went home that day and I told my husband that I needed to go to rehab. I had no idea what that meant. I had no idea how to make that happen. Neither did he. I remember I'm a blackout drinker, so a lot of this is stuff I've been told and from the best of my recollection. And so there was an argument between me and my husband or a disagreement. He didn't quite, you know, he was probably feared up. Like, what do you mean you're going to go to rehab? Like, what does that mean? How much does it cost, you know? And, like, where do we find one? And how do you do that? And how long are you going to be gone? And do you just go and get fixed and come back and you can drink wine again? Like, what's the deal? Like, we didn't know. But it wasn't going well. I know that. The conversation wasn't going well. So I did what every 43-year-old excellent alcoholic does, is they call their daddy. So I called daddy and I said, you know, dad, I think I need to go to rehab. And he probably said 3 hallelujahs, a Hail Mary, and donated money to St. Jude or something. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? But he's like, no shit, you know? And he's like, what do you need me to do? And I'm like, you need to come here now. And my dad showed up. And the interesting thing about that, and I won't even go into that whole story because I could talk 2 days about that, is that my entire life from the time I was 3, my parents were separated and my mom took the kids to Florida and my dad stayed up here. And all I knew was, like, anytime dad was involved, mom was crying and Renee was crying and my brother was crying. It was dad, sadness in the house, right? Dad, arguments in the house. And so from the age of 3, you know, I have this twisted idea of my father, right? And I put up this huge wall growing up over the years and I pushed him away and I didn't need him until I needed something, right? And it was usually, dad, I need money. I have to get some dental work. Dad, I need money. I'm in a jam. Dad, I need money. Dad, I need money. And dad was always there for me. But I never made any effort to get close to this man, right? But I totally used him when I needed something, and he always came through. It's a little different today. I know some truths today that maybe I'll share with you. But I called my dad, and here he is, this man who I've pushed away my whole entire life, shows up yet again. And I told him the truth. You know, I can remember it was me, my stepmother, and my husband in the living room having this conversation. Why we're talking so long, I don't know, because I'm going to change my mind in a hot second. And I took my dad in the kitchen and I said, "Dad, I'm covered in bruises from head to toe. My hair is falling out. I drink 24/7. I cannot breathe without drinking. To stop drinking is completely impossible. The words don't even go together. They don't make sense in my mind. Breathing, not drinking, like how do you not, like it's not happening. There's no way I can do it. I can't even comprehend the idea of not drinking. And I need help." And he made a phone call. My brother had been in rehab twice before, so my dad kind of knew a place. And he made a phone call, and apparently, I always thought, like, dad had some connections there. Like, he made a big donation, and so, like, when Wayne called, like, there, we got a bed for you. But clearly God had a plan, because I found out that truth not too long ago, a couple weeks ago. Dad told me he had no idea what I was talking about. They just said, "We'll have a bed cleared out, you know, tomorrow, bring her tomorrow." And I remember my dad saying, you know, "Go upstairs and pack a bag." And I must have gone upstairs and packed a bag. And the next morning I wake up and I'm feeling that, you know, so sick again. I'm so sick. And I open my eye and I see that pink fucking bedroom. And I'm like, shit. I completely overreacted last night. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I can't believe I'm in my father's bedroom, like, spare bedroom. Like, something, how am I got to get out of this one? There's no way. I'm going to this rehab. And I hear the footsteps come up the steps. And it's my sister. "We're going to rehab." Right? She like searches my bags, and I think I had no clothes. I had underwear and a sock or something, and lots of makeup and hair products and a hair dryer and hairspray. And I didn't have any clothes. So I went to rehab in my dad's clothes. I was a beaut. Yeah, I looked great. My sister had to put me in the shower. I was so sick. And I can remember, like, here we go. I'm actually going to this rehab. I'm scared to death. All I want is a drink. Like, people, just give me a drink. I'll be fine. And you know, I get in my dad's car. My stepmother comes out. She hands me this, like, medallion with the Blessed Mother on it. And she's praying. And the whole ride down, my dad's offering me, like, fancy water. I'm like, dude, like, vodka. You know, like. And we get there, my husband's there, and I go through that intake process. I was not a direct admit. So if any of you know what it's like to sit in that intake process at a rehab, you're there, which seemed like weeks. I was sitting there so sick. I cried the whole time. And they admitted me, and they took all my stuff. I'm like, my phone, you know, like no communication, and I'm scared to death. Well, after I woke up, a couple days later, you know, after I detoxed and started feeling better, I loved it there. You know, I was in this safe environment and I wasn't drinking. Like, it was crazy, right? Like, I can't believe I'm not drinking. And I can't believe I like it here. You know, I ended up having my own room and we did volleyball and I could get massages. They had equine therapy, but the horses weren't there. That pissed me off. It was good. Volleyball, yeah, the food was decent. You know, like I said, my own room. And after 28 days, I see like everyone's leaving. People are in and out, and I'm still here. And I'm like, why am I still here? Well, eventually, that day 32, they tell me I'm going home. And panic stricken. Like, I just did a 32-day stint without drinking in here. Now I got to go out there. Right? I got to go see my sister who's been telling me I drink too much and I have a drinking problem since I was like 5 probably. Well, that's, I exaggerate. We're alcoholics. We exaggerate. Since forever. I have to go see my father who I would only call when I needed something and pushed out of my life and how much hurt and pain I did to that man. I have to go see my mom who was my cohort in crime. Right? We were best buds and You know, she'd be slipping me wine on the side when my husband would tell me no more, right? Like, how do I go back and be, how do I face these people? Like, how do I go back to my mom, right? And my best friend, and you know, she's pretty good for smoking bowls and, you know, doing lines and drinking a lot of wine. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to be around that anymore, right? Like, I have to go out of here and try to stay sober. And my best friend is my mom, and she does all these things that I like to do. And my sister, who knows I'm an alcoholic forever, and my dad, and the job that would find me passed out on the floor and reeking of alcohol every day. Like, how do you go back? The guilt, the shame, and remorse was so overwhelming that there was no way, because alcohol is my relief. You know, alcohol's the answer, you know. When I have to go see my dad, I get pre-gamed up, you know what I mean, before I go. When my job is yelling at me, fuck it, go to the bar and get loaded. I don't need that job. When my first husband's leaving me, to him too, let me just go get loaded. You know, when something's bothering me, alcohol is my solution to everything. Alcohol is my solution to happiness, right? Let's party. You know, I mean... But it was. It did for me incredible things, right? And now I have to go out and face all of these emotions and live life sober, and I didn't think I was ever going to be able to do that. My husband, so I'm all fear-stricken again, right? On day 32, my husband picks me up, and he says, I'm going to take you to this meeting. It was a Friday night. And I go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I need to go in there and say, hi, my name's Adrian, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not shy, so I really didn't have a problem with that. I had to get a home group, totally didn't know what that meant, so I didn't need one. Needed a sponsor, nobody knows myself better than me, so I don't need nobody. The 12 steps was like, wah, 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 whatever. I had this book that everybody wrote, like, don't let anyone take your joy away. Call me for coffee. Stay happy. You know, like my autograph book was my big book. And so that's as much as I knew about that book, is that it had a lot of my friends from rehab's phone numbers in it. You know, and then I needed to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I had MacGyver on my back, my husband, right? He had a plan, I suppose, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. In that, it was in a hospital setting, and one room was Alcoholics Anonymous. Right next door was Al-Anon. He went to Al-Anon, I went to AA. And I raised my hand, and they did the preamble and the opening, and, you know, they asked if anybody was new, and I said, yes, I just got out of rehab today. And a woman, like, got up from her seat, just like we welcomed you. This woman came up, and she gave me this great big hug. And she said, Adrian, you're in the right place. It's going to be okay. You know, welcome. And, you know, I got some ease and comfort, right? I'm like, she likes me. I might come back, right? Like, because I'm driven by what people think of me, right? So this lady's loving on me. I need to get some loving. Right? Because it's all about me. Still is today, but a little bit better. And so I got this ease and comfort from this woman. This woman probably set the tone for me going to Alcoholics Anonymous meeting the next day, right? I don't think if I walked into that room and didn't feel welcomed that I necessarily would have gone back the next day. You know what I mean? So I think it's really important how we greet people when we come to meetings, right? Who's walking in your home group? Have you greeted them? Have you made them feel welcome? It might be their first meeting. I know that woman did something for me, which I now know was her, the God within her, was tapping into this God within me, right? She woke something up that was deep, deep buried down inside of me. She woke up something inside of me that I didn't know was there, right? It was a God moment for me, you know, that I actually liked this meeting, that I, you know, like I felt at home, like she was my people, right? She was my girl, right? She was like my long-lost aunt coming up and giving me this great big hug like she'd known me her whole life, and I just met the woman. Like, you know what that's like in AA. You meet people, and we're instantly friends, right? We've known each other forever because we're exactly the same. We suffer from that same malady, and we connect with the language of the heart, right? And our spirits are forever connected in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know. It was beautiful. I didn't know then exactly everything I just said. All I knew was I was coming back to AA. So I start my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I start going to meetings. I'm not having that same experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to say I was in AA for a few months. I was actually only in AA for 2 weeks because I recently gave a sponsee a little journal. I suggested that she start writing some stuff down. And I said, here's a journal. And I gave it to her. Well, there was some of my old stuff in that journal. And it was dated 2 weeks after I got home from rehab. And the stuff that she showed me that was written in that journal were things that my first sponsor told me. So I know that I heard that message 2 weeks after getting out of rehab, you know, and I would tell you that it seemed like months, right? I mean, this is my first go around in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am just a toddler here. I'm a baby in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know shit, so don't listen to anything I'm saying. Like, I'm still learning, right? And so within 2 weeks, I end up at this meeting that I hadn't really been to before, and there's a woman there after the meeting, and she raises her hand, and she says, hi, my name is Jen, and I'm really passionate about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they're outlined in this book. If there's anybody in here that would like a better way of living, it would be my honor and privilege to show you what I did. Well, I thought, well, you better pick me, right? Like, I want that. I have that book, right? She's holding up the book, and I remember going, oh, my God, I have that book. And she's cute, and she's pretty, and she had a sparkle in her eyes, and her whole deportment shouted, I have an answer, right? The words that came out of her mouth shouted she had an answer, right? Because my long career of 2 weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous sucked, right? Being sober wasn't fun. Being sober was difficult. Being sober was not fun and exciting, you know? Being sober today is fun and exciting. You know, there's a complete difference from being sober and being recovered. You know, I believe that I've crossed over into that state of having, of being recovered. I'm not just not drinking. A psychic change has happened to me. There is clearly something different, and I know that because my brother-in-law told my husband. So take that. Right? Something's different about Adrian. I don't know what it is, but whatever she's doing, she better... Sounds like a story out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, doesn't it? Bill's story. I don't know what happened, Bill, but whatever happened, you better hold on to it. So my brother-in-law said to my husband, I don't know what happened to her, but this AA thing, it's working for her, right? Because I'm a different person today. So I tell this lady, pick me. She gives me her phone number. And I get out to the parking lot. I'm so excited. And I call her. And she's like, still in the building, Adrian, you better slow down. Take it easy, right? Slogan, take it easy. And she said, call her later. So, you know, a few hours went by and I called her, and that was a Thursday night, and she set up an appointment for me to meet with her that weekend. I don't know if it was a Saturday, Sunday, don't matter. But I know that it was like ungodly early. It was like at 8 a.m. Like, who the hell gets up at freaking 8 a.m., right, on a weekend, you know? People that are awakened do, right? I'm up early. You know, you get an awakened spirit and you get this love for living, right? So something happened right there, right? And so we set up this meeting and she starts talking to me about some stuff. You know, again, today I know it was the language of the heart. You know, she talked about how she used to walk around her house and look at the yellow in her eyes to see if she could drink another day. Jaundice. I work in gastroenterology, so I know everything that was happening to my body. My liver was shutting down. My liver function studies were through the roof. My doctors, I would go up and show them results. And they go, oh, man, that person's in bad shape. And they were mine, you know. But I'd be like, oh, this is my friend, you know. Like, and she used to walk around and look at the yellow in her eyes. So, like, I connected with her, and I was like, oh, my God, she does that too. But she doesn't do that anymore. Right? So something had happened to her. If she was as bad as I was, you know, then then, and she's not anymore. Whatever she did, you damn straight, I want two of them because I'm an alcoholic. So I want two. And something happened. I started to trust her, right? So she started me on the journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. We sat down in a group setting with a bunch of women, and they pulled out this book, and they had me underline and highlight some stuff, and they took me through the very beginning, the blank page. And I love how you read the set-aside prayer before you start. I'm glad you did that. That was the first thing they taught me. They said, Adrian, you need to be a blank page. Whatever you think you know, because I know everything, about anything, needs to be set aside temporarily. Like, whatever you think you know about recovery, you need to put it aside. Whatever you think you know about being sober, you need to put aside. Anything you think you know about the 12 steps, set aside. These people, set it all aside. You know, dear God, help me set aside everything that I think I know about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, this big book, and especially you, dear God. Help me set it all aside, so that I can have a much needed new experience with all of these things. Clearly, I needed it. I'm sitting on a Saturday morning at 8 a.m. in some girl's apartment talking about God. Like, clearly, like, if I'm sitting there, I need, something is wrong, right? And I need this program. And I was willing to do that. And we started there, and she pointed out the progression of this disease, and that my mind and my body's a marvelous mechanism, and if I don't do something about it now, like, I can endure this alcoholic torture, that same torture from that morning, being so sick without the drink and being so sick with it, you know, and not wanting to look at myself in the mirror and being so disgusted with my behavior. Like, I could go on like that a long time. You know, the body and the mind are marvelous mechanisms. They can endure the alcoholic torture for a long time. And could I see the progression? Well, yeah, I had a blast when I was 17 to 27, right? And then it wasn't fun anymore. Then it went from being fun and partying without consequences to consequences, and my sister handled a lot of my consequences, you know what I mean? Like, fixed my problems for me, and people did that for me. And so it wasn't like I ever had a really ugly, hard hit. It was an internal problem going on, right? And I felt the internal pain, and I could not go on that way anymore. And I saw the progression, right? They pointed it out. Can you see the progression? And you know that if you continue like this, it's going to get worse. We're telling you, and I believed them. And they told me as long as I, you know, that they explained what was wrong. They explained the doctor's opinion to me. We read through it line by line, and the physical allergy, and I'm sure all of you know about it, but since my family's here and they don't, I'm going to talk about it. You know, we talk about this physical allergy. Once I put the substance in my body demands more. Me and my sister go to Lancaster, and we're going to go shopping, and we sit at the bar, and we start drinking. And she can leave a half a bar on the counter, and I'm going back to drink it. You know, and like that just starts my party. She can go shopping, right? I'm shopping for an eight ball. Like, you know, like the progression and wanting more, right? Something is physically different in my body than it is my sister's. She can turn it off. I cannot turn it off. She can control and enjoy her drinking. I cannot control and enjoy my drinking. If I am controlling it, which never was the case for me, my husband was always controlling it, or somebody else was controlling it, I was not enjoying it. As quite frankly, I'd make scenes at restaurants, right? If somebody was trying to control my drinking. And, you know, and that my mind always takes me back, right? For some reason, my mind will always justify putting that substance in my body again, putting the drink in my body again. And here we go with that phenomenon of craving again, the physical allergy, right? So I don't think that I've ever not drank for a day. I think I did it once or twice, and I got really freaking pissed off that nobody threw me a party because I didn't drink for 2 days, that it just made for more drinking. You know what I mean? Like, where's my party? I didn't drink for 2 days. What do you mean you didn't notice? My husband points out now that he did notice, but it didn't warrant a party, which pissed me off too, but whatever. I wrote out a 4-column inventory on it. I'm good. So, And so, you know, so that I suffered, like, and it's in this book written by a medical doctor who studied alcoholic and drug addiction his entire career. And it's medical, right? Like, I get the doctor. I work for doctors my whole life. I get it. You know, that here's a schooled person telling me that I suffer from this phenomenon, this allergy to alcohol, that there is something different with me, which started to melt away a little bit of the guilt, shame, and remorse that I left that rehab with, right? Because there's, it wasn't that I just totally disrespected my husband and didn't care about what he wanted, or I had couldn't live by moral principles or anything like that. You know, it was that I suffered from this illness that was way bigger than my willpower ever. Right? Coupled together with the physical allergy and the mental obsession, I'm fucked. I gotta have something. And the book tells me I have to have this spiritual awakening. And when the ladies told me that, I told them they were nuts. Because I've been to Pentecostal church and I've seen people roll on the floor and talk in tongue and like, ugh, weird shit happens. Not that there's anything wrong with the Pentecostal church. Just saying, I don't want it. Right? And that's why that set of prayer, a side prayer, came in really handy. Because when they told me that I need to have this psychic change, this spiritual awakening, I go right to the Pentecostal church and think, hell no, I don't want that. Right? And she's like, Adrian, you're in my freaking living room. What's the difference? Like, your life sucks. You suck at managing it. Just try it. Right? If it doesn't work, go back and drink again. Nobody cares. You know what I mean? And I'm like, huh, how dare she talk to me like that? You know, like, but she was right, you know, like, try it. What do you have to lose? We go through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. She has us all in a circle holding hands. I'm thinking this is really getting weird. We do this prayer, this third step prayer. I don't even know what it means, right? And they hand me a pink notebook. And I have this spiritual experience. They hand me a pink notebook and they say, go home, Adrian, and write down how the world has wronged you. And I'm like, yes! Right? I wrote and 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 I wrote. I went to every meeting early. I stayed late. Soon as I walked home, I'd take my shoes off. I'd sit at the dining room table and I'd write, write, write. Because, you know, the world really wronged me for 43 years. And I had a lot to bitch about, and all these people were going to be on that stand, and they were going to hell, all of them. And why, in the first three columns, and I loved it, right? And then they sent me down, and she says, now we're going to take a look at it from an entirely different angle. Well, I was like, shit, this is not going to be good, I can tell you right now. And it was beautiful, right? I learned some big chunks of truth. You know, the realities, the truth that I have been living my life and the decisions that I have been making based on fear, about resentments towards people, were really bad decisions and actions that I took. And it was very, very clear after she pointed them out. Helped me to see the truth, right? She helped me to see the truth about me. She, even things that were justified, right? Justified resentments. We're not qualified to have them. I'm a victim of a violent crime. This bitch is going to tell me that I had a fourth column on this one? I don't think so, right? But she helped me to see the truth, right? And what happened is, you know, although I'm a victim of a violent crime, and I'm not saying it's justified, that anybody should suffer through it, and you're not, there's no reason to be angry, because I get it, I was angry, but I can tell you there's a way past it through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a way past it where God can take something really horrific that happens to you and allows it to be one of your greatest tools in helping other people, right? Psychic change, a new way of looking at things, a different perspective. You know, God let that happen to me, or I survived that situation because God needed me to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous helping another woman who suffered the same thing, right? Like, that's how I look at it now, right? And it's a beautiful thing. So justified resentment, hell yeah, but I'm not qualified to have one. And she helped me turn it around in a gently, you know, loving but forceful manner. Helped me to see the truth, right? I didn't like some of the things she told me about myself. I didn't like, you know, a lot of things. You know, that the whole thing with my father, you know. You know, he was fighting for custody for his children. I didn't freaking know that. You know what I mean? Like, if anybody took three children from New Jersey to Florida today, there'd probably be a big problem, right? I mean, I don't know how horrific it must have been for my parents with a nasty custody child, battle over three kids across the states. You know what I mean? And so I, Jen said to me, well, if my husband took my kids, I'd have a freaking gun. And I would not mind going to jail to get my kids back. Do you think maybe your dad was just fighting for custody for you guys? And I was like, oh, maybe he was. You know what I mean? Like, so it wasn't this delusion. Like, the delusion was smashed in my head about my truth, right? At the age of 43. The truth that I thought I was justified in having, I realized were not the truth at all. They were made up in my head, right? For whatever reasons. And when I went through the amends process with my dad, you know, he told me it's never too late to be daddy's little girl and that he should have fought harder for us kids. You know, like it was an amazing experience sitting down at the table making amends to my father for my behaviors over the years. But again, that's like another 3-hour topic we can talk about. So I go through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and I go through and I start cleaning up the wreckage of my past, right? I see the truth. And I'm told to go home with as much enthusiasm. And we went over an amends list and the proper way to make an amends and the proper things to say to these people. And to go out with all the enthusiasm I did as writing the fourth step to go make these amends. And while doing that, to read pages 84 through 88 out of the big book twice a day, which I thought was total overkill. First of all, why'd I have to do it twice a day was my first question. And second of all, well, for how long do I have to do that? And she told me to shut up and just do it. She was great with words. And I did. And it didn't dawn on me that what I was reading just because she told me to read it. Like, she let me go a little bit, right? She's giving me a little bit, you're a big girl now, you can do this. And because she held my hand through the first half of this journey. And now she's giving me a little freedom. I didn't realize I was supposed to be doing what 84 through 88 says, right? If you don't know what 84 through 88 says, you better go home and read your big book tonight. And you better do it. Because it's the ticket to your freedom. Right, or the maintenance of your freedom, I should say. You need to clear out some wreckage, right? So recognizing all of these things about myself and understanding my disease and why I did some of the things that I did and going out and cleaning up the wreckage that I've caused allowed me to get some of this shit that was blocking me from tapping into this power that's deep down within, right? Deep down within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. I believe that God is within me, that I am a piece of His energy living inside this body, and I need to plug in every day, just like that lamp needs to be plugged into electric to turn on, right? I need to plug in if I want to be a light unto the world. If I want to be a servant for God and be useful to Him, I need to tap into that power, His power, on a daily basis, and I do that through prayer and meditation. But I could go through prayer and meditation all I want. If I'm blocked, I ain't gonna get plugged in real good, right? That's where that self-examination comes in throughout the day. Where was I resentful today? Where did I make decisions based on fear? Where did I, you know, did I step on the toes of others at all? You know, or did I pack into the stream of life? Was I being a servant for God? What could I have done better? Like all of these things in steps 10 and 11, you know, intertwined together. And I get unblocked, right? I clean up things as I go. Anyway, I go home. So I'm reading this and I'm not doing what it's saying. And I go out and I make my first phone call to make an amends. And it was going to be to an employer for a big institution that I worked for 10 years. And it was going to be to my manager. And I was all excited. And I make the phone call as soon as I get home. It's Sunday night and she doesn't answer. And then I freaking send her an email and she doesn't answer. And then I send her a text and she doesn't reply. And she's not getting back to me, so now I'm getting another resentment. Like, how come this woman's not getting back to me? And it's Monday, and about 4 o'clock, my phone rings, and I see it's the institution. My stomach drops, and I answer the phone, and it's not her. It's not her boss's boss. It's her boss's boss's boss, like the big Mahatma at the hospital. And they want to know the nature of my incessant need to reach this woman, like I'm going to burn the hospital down or something. I've had thoughts of slashing tires there in the past, but I never thought of burning the hospital down. But it was like this big, like, oh, my God, why is she calling? And I'm like, I told him, I said, I'm on a spiritual journey, and it includes cleaning up the wreckage of my past, and I feel like I've harmed her immensely, and I wanted to know if she would allow me the opportunity to sit down with her. And the woman on the phone said, I can tell you, by no means does this woman ever want to see you again. As a matter of fact, please stop calling the hospital and don't ever come back here. And I thought, whew, got out of that one. Whew. I was like, that was a piece of cake. And that was 4:30, right? So 5 o'clock comes around, I clock out of work, I go to my car, and I sit down in my car, and I have this overwhelming emotional breakdown. Like, holy shit. I was that awful to that woman that she wants nothing to do with me ever, ever again. I'm a nice person. You know, like, I was so delusional. Like, I just didn't think I was capable of being perceived that way. You know what I mean? That I actually did so much damage to this person that they wouldn't talk. And I cried and I cried and I called my sponsor and I'm like, Jen, she won't talk to me. And she's like, well, sweetheart, I don't know what to tell you. It sounds like you're having a God moment. I'll check on you later. Click. Like, I got to get a new sponsor. I need some emotional support here. And but she was right. Who was she to interfere with God's disciplining of me, right? Like, God was teaching me a lesson. God was allowing me to feel probably the way I made other people feel, right? So, karma? I don't know. A God moment, for sure. You know, to experience the negativity that I've put on other people, you know, and the realization, right? It humbled me. It made me really small and let me see what a piece of shit I really was. I've had amazing amends stories. I've never made amends to that woman. I was not instructed to reach out again for a long time. Hopefully God will put her in my path and I stand ready. You know, I stand ready for anybody that God presents to me to admit my faults, you know, my mistakes and where I've harmed them. So, beautiful journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I clean it all up and now I have to maintain it, right? How do I stay free? I got free in the amends process. I didn't know crap when I did the third step. The fifth step was cool, right? Didn't like most of it, but I get it, you know. But when I started making amends, something happened, right? Something happened to me on the inside, like pieces started getting put back together. And I was able to tap into this power. I can remember my sponsor saying to me, are you praying? Are you praying? Are you praying? And I'm like, yeah, I'm praying. I was not praying, you know. But I've developed prayer, right? I mean, it's something that you have to develop and it's something that you have to nurture. And the spiritual world has to be maintained, the spiritual way of living, right? I need to, like, if I have a beautiful garden, not that I'm a gardener by any means, it's just a really good example. If I have a beautiful garden and I want it to stay beautiful, I'm going to have to take out the crabgrass and the weeds, right? I'm going to have to get dirty a little bit and I'm going to have to clean some stuff up out of that garden if I want it to stay beautiful. I'm going to have to water it, right? Maybe put some fertilizer. I want to put some sunlight on it, right? I need to do that for my soul, right? I have to keep it clean. I have to keep this, you know, connection clear, right? So I need to tap into the power. I need to be in the sunlight. You know, I feel like something has clearly happened to me and I feel this inner peace and this inner knowing. I was motivated by fear to get sober, right? Motivated totally by fear. Running on fear, I'm going to lose another job. Motivated by fear. And that fear motivated me to go into treatment, and it got me into Alcoholics Anonymous, and through the 12-step process, I went from, you know, being motivated by fear to crossing over to this inner knowing, to being inspired, like inhaling spirit, right? Take it in, right? Get quiet, get centered. To being inspired now, knowing deep down in my soul that I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be here, right now, doing exactly what I'm doing, or else I would not be doing it, right? God would have put a tree down, and then I wouldn't have been here, because you needed someone else to be here. Like, I believe everything happens in this world, in God's world, exactly the way it's supposed to. Nothing happens by mistake. And as long as I can remember that I believe that, I'm good. Problem is, I'm a forgetter, and I forget that I really do believe that. I believe, I know, inner knowing, like there's something completely different than I believe something that somebody tells me, to having this inner knowing, right? I know now that God has been directing my life this whole time to bring me here tonight to you, to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, to help his kids, to go through and be a messenger of that beautiful big blue book. Where is it? How come you don't have a book around here? Fail. You guys fail me on the book. That's close enough. But inspired, right? So I know that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I found a purpose for living. I can remember being on the fetal position in my mother's house sobbing. I don't know why I'm here. You know, I'm a piece of shit, no good, loser. Like, why did God even create me to, like, not even wanting to be here, to standing before you today knowing that I have a purpose, that I serve God, that I'm here to help his kids, and to talk about recovery and Alcoholics Anonymous and how to tap into a power on a daily basis and how to stay free, right? Not just sober, free. And for that, I'm forever grateful. And Jeff, thanks for having me. So y'all have a good night.